Hey guys, it's Brock Cannon here. Thanks so much in advance for listening to the Brock Cannon podcast. I wanted to just give you guys all a heads up on this episode. We had a glitch in the recording. It literally dropped off about 37 minutes in, so you're going to kind of experience a break. It's a great transition from our conversation of kind of some deeper stuff and then moving into ultra running and some of the psychology behind that. But I just wanted to give you all a heads up. Stay tuned. Don't go away, because the last part of this episode is potentially some of the most awesome aha moments that I've had in a long time, and I hope that it will do the same for you. So thanks so much for listening, guys. All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Brock Cannon podcast. I'm your host, Brock Cannon. Very excited today about my guest. This guy is someone that I admired for quite some time now, and he's an runner, lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, entrepreneur, and just an all-around good dude. And we're super stoked to get into some conversation here today. As you guys know, on this podcast, we have guests of all backgrounds, walks of life, and Brian, whom I've admired for a long time now, and I'm super pumped to get into some conversation, get into his mind a little bit. And this mega positive dude is how he is wired, so we can learn something from that today. Brian, welcome to the podcast, my man.
Hey, thanks, Brock. Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So, Brian, for those of us that don't know too much of your story, our listeners, give us just a little bit of background on you. Where did you grow up originally? And maybe, you know, start from the time of kindergarten and go on. No, I'm just kidding.
Don't start. Yeah. I know. It's kind of like the life story. Yeah, I think I could give a very quick, relatively quick synopsis, not to bore anybody. But yeah, I did grow up in the Bay Area, in Marin County, and then I left when I was 16. Had lots of issues with not going to school, drugs, and whatnot. And then I went to this really cool Quaker school, not religious Quaker, but you know, more nudity Quaker than religious. So hippie Quakers. So then I did that for 2 years, got my stuff together, went to Reed College, which most people now know as a really tough academic school. Did that, lots of world travel. Once again, had a pretty good size maintenance drug habit. Then went to graduate school, met my wife. We went and lived down in Austin, Texas. And we moved back to the Bay Area, 18 years ago. And I got into a lot of trouble. I was running my own businesses. Very isolated, very alone, and developed a pretty nasty drug addiction, which I was able to overcome 12 years ago, and got back into running since my early childhood, running around Mount Tamalpais. Got back into that 5 years ago because my sponsor in recovery is also a distance runner. Bit by bit, he got me addicted to this wonderful community and activity. So that's really quick in where I come from. That's my general background.
Awesome. Okay, so you've intrigued me with a couple of points. First of all, I want to hear about the Quaker commune. I want to hear, what was that like? Was it like, you know, was it actually like a shared work community, or like,
oh,
how
yeah.
Talking here? I want to hear this.
I am so glad you asked, because that really is one of the times, even though, you know, I was, you know, still taking lots of, you know, psychedelics and pot and stuff like that. It was actually one of the bigger kind of spiritual awakenings I had, non-religious sense. But what I did was just how I found out about it, and my parents were always threatening me with boarding school, right? Oh, we're gonna have to send you away, blah, blah, blah. And then one day I come back home and I'm like, hey, I found this real cool school, send me away. They're like, no way. Not that place. So they did their research and they're like, okay, that sounds good. So what it is it's a regular, they tried to be pretty much a college prep school, but not for really. There were some people who would never go to college there, but not really any troubled youth or anything like that. It was just a place to get a bigger experience about life, to do academics, but also to work with your hands. Everybody lived on in the community. It was farm and garden, kitchen. We weren't self-sustaining, but everybody worked. We had like series of work jobs. So I learned to cook. I learned about animal husbandry. I grew food, learned how to do all that stuff. So it was a very enriching time. But besides that...
Now, hold on, Ryan. Yeah. And how old were you at this time?
That was 16 years old.
Wow. Okay.
So then what the main, I guess, when I talk about spiritual thrust, had to do with community, had to do with the fact that we were, 45 kids living out in the woods, all working together for the common cause of learning and surviving and exploring who we were. But those relationships were so deep, and this is kind of the Quaker end. They were so deep because you learn each other through common work. And that's one of the things in the ultra running community. We all share, in a sense, a deep pain center, if you will, for the endurance we go through. And we're all in it together. And there's a very, like, you know, when I talk about spiritual, I'm talking about when somebody says, wow, that's a spirited horse. We don't mean that's a religious horse. We mean that religion is full of, I mean, that horse is full of energy, is really taking in the world.
Okay, so this is so fascinating to me. So there's 45 out in the woods. You're, you know, walk me through what was a typical day, if there was a typical day.
Yeah, there were 6 days of classes, because we didn't have that many hours of classes. Let's just take one day when I would have your work jobs would change every semester. You got some choices, but I might start the day at 5 a.m. milking goats and then feeding the babies, which was really fun. Because I'd milk them, and then I'd put two bottles in my hands, two bottles under my arms, and a bottle between my knees, and about 10 goats would just tackle me. They would eat. I had really long hair. They'd eat at my hair, and you know, it was really, really fun. But then I would scratch the hogs with a bamboo rake. I might do a little mucking, which means, you know, getting rid of gross hay and putting some new hay down. And then from there, you know, we'd have breakfast as a group. You know, we had a little mess hall. Somebody else would be on the breakfast crew, you know, cooking. You know, there'd be other people doing different jobs. So then I'd do that, a couple classes, go back to my cabin. You shared a cabin. There was one side of the campus, which was, quote, the boys' side. I put that in quotes because we slept wherever with whoever we wanted. So, I mean, it was very loose in that way, but we had a code of responsibility. So I'd do that. I'd have classes, this or that throughout the day. And then maybe I would have on that same day dinner prep. And so I would be in the kitchen prepping and cooking dinner for 45. So you learn how to feed a lot of people. You learn a lot about cooking. Or let's say if I didn't have that, I might have dinner cleanup or some kind of lunch duty. So you mixed your classes with your other duties. And, you know, once a week we'd have silent meeting. Once a week we'd have community meeting. For the most part, I would just say it's a day of that, and also of a hike up into the woods, because we had lots of property. And we might do fun things like that. Or we'd hike down to the Yuba River and sun ourselves on the rocks there. Absolutely gorgeous river in the Sierra Nevada foothills.
So, okay, you're 16, you're doing this work. Did you enjoy the work? Was it?
Oh, God, yeah. Yes.
You did?
Yes, the work was fun. I mean, we brought just as the kids, you know, you get there, there's always a couple that don't like it. Why would we work? Why would we have to work? Don't we pay to go here? Blah, blah, blah. But you see pretty soon that every staff member's child is, we're all doing it together. So that's the joy. The joy is that it has to get done, but we're all going to do it together.
Right.
It just made sense to me. It's not like chores per se, but it was a way to step up, maybe. Maybe it was a way for me to get respect.
That's very interesting. So looking back, I mean, it sounds like this was one of the... How many years were you actually there, Brian?
Just two.
2 years. So 16 to 18.
Yeah.
And, I mean, do you look back on your life and feel like that was one of the experiences that really shaped who you are today?
Yes, absolutely. And that's why I'm so glad you went right to that, is that's probably... Yeah, In terms of what I aim for in life, which is connection with others, common work, compassion, feeling something greater than yourself, that you're working for something greater than yourself. I crave all those things in life. I'm really the basis of love, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, is this school still in operation today, or?
Unfortunately not. It is still a Quaker run. They have like, I don't know much about it, but they do have I guess they call it the Woolman semester, where some people are able to go there when they are students and work on projects with their hands and stuff and get some academics, but it's not the same. No, it's not a full school accredited school.
I gotcha. Well, that's really beautiful, and I can appreciate that. I didn't have experience, but when I was, I want to say 13, 14, for about a month every summer, I would go up to a boys' ranch just near Driggs, Idaho, on the backside of the mountains. And it was wonderful. And we would wake up early. We'd work all sorts of various jobs till probably about noon. And it was hard work. I mean, baling hay, building fences, doing whatever, building cabins. And, you know, I remember initially thinking, this kind of sucks. Like, why do we have to work? But then we'd eat lunch and then we were free the rest of the day to go and, you know, hike up in the Tetons or go canoeing or go fly fishing or do all sorts of things. And ended up loving it. Now, I did run away one summer. That's a whole other story. you know, I look back and my parents were getting divorced, and I don't think I even really processed at the time the hormones and turmoil I was going through at 13. But yeah, looking back, like I can just appreciate learning how to work hard. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really cool. So let me ask you this with, you know, and I won't make this too big of a rabbit trail here with education. Sure. You know, you've been to college and higher education. Looking back at that experience, I mean, do you feel like we should have more schools like that today, or at least programs that teach kids that type of stuff? Or
yes, I mean, absolutely. I think kids need to have, in a sense, skin in the game. They need to be participants in the world. Now, you know, some countries used to have mandatory either military or civilian service, but that seems a little too governmental, you know, a little too like big for the same kind of experience maybe I had. But yeah, I think besides working with your hands, it's working with others on common cause. I think the one thing we lose in our society is being a part of it. And I think when you start maybe on this micro level with the community, you understand how you should give back on a civic level. So I think it's extremely important for the development of a happy individual to be a participant in in all phases of their world, and to reach out and to give help and to give love and support. And I think that starts at an early age. I think you can teach those morals, or you can show them, or they can do them. And, you know, I was an anthropologist, so I always believe that as humans, 99% of our existence was as hunter-gatherers. So we have this small communal participant spirituality through community based in our soul, in our marrow, deep, deep down. And I think, you know, this modern society, this is all kind of an experiment still. You know, people living in gated communities, they don't know their neighbors, the blah, blah, blah. That isolation, I think, leads to neuroses, fear, materialism, things to fill up that donut hole that we've left from maybe an older way of life. I'm not saying that older way of life was better. I'm just saying that's what it is, that we do have that. And we're not necessarily taking care of that in the way we educate our children and live our lives. So that's kind of one of my big deals.
Well, I love that. And that's something I've noticed about you just from, you know, our interactions and following you on social media, is just how plugged into the community you are, and not even just the ultra running community, but it seems to me like everyone knows Brian Paisley. He's out there. He's supportive. You're always going to races. You're pacing people. So we're going to get into ultra running in just a sec. But
okay.
I think you bring up a really good point with, you know, people plugging into the community to feel a better sense of belonging, to contribute more to the world. So someone who's maybe more introverted or shy, or it's not natural for them, so to speak, to go out into the community and to be super involved, how do you recommend somebody become more involved in their community? Any starting points or thought processes there?
Oh, yeah. I think it starts... I mean, for instance, there can be people who are depressed and introverted, or depressed and extroverted. It doesn't really, if you're depressed or whatever, but it is finding common people that maybe at first share your shyness. And, but I also think it's one of those things that you through the work. So I would volunteer, maybe. I would do things that required maybe not as much talking or, you know, direct interaction, but going and cooking in a kitchen for to feed homeless or something like that, where you're together with people, you're working, you get to know them through the art of work. I would say that, but I'm not necessarily one of those people. I'm in extreme downtime. I love to not isolate, but I love my solitude. But whenever I interact or can be in a situation where I do, I come out. Same thing with my wife. So I think it's also, I might not know that type of person enough to give that advice, but I do think through the doing of work, it's not necessarily about liking people or talking a lot. I do think it's about helping people. So I think it's part of an ego transformation. We have to get outside of ourselves. And sometimes my shyness is because I care too much about how people see me. And I think, you know, as we get older, we relax that. Or if you work on that through spiritual pursuits or whatever you do, meditation, seeing the world as bigger than you, the more we can let go of those inhibitions.
I love that. That's great advice, I think, for somebody to kind of get out there. You know, it's interesting. I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and, it's very heavily populated, obviously. A lot of the community aspect is revolved around the church there, and as Salt Lake City has kind of developed more into not a 100% Mormon community, but literally almost half and half now, you see a lot of people kind of feel like they're outsiders or isolated. And that was always one of the biggest challenges that I saw, that from people that had kind of moved there. But it's fascinating now that I've moved out, Santa Barbara, California. I've been here over a year. When you don't have a church or a specific group that you're already kind of grandfathered into, I think it forces you to have to get out into the community. And I'm sure there's other, communities that are very heavily religiously dominated with a specific church or sect where, maybe there is a feeling of that. But I think that's great advice, getting out volunteering. And I mean, what better people could you meet than people that are volunteering? So I love that. I love that. And I think that's phenomenal. Just a little Brian. Let's kind of go to, you mentioned some of the darker years.
Yes.
Where drug addiction came into play. And then ultimately I want to get into your brain a little bit about how you transferred out of that. So tell me kind of when some of that dark period started, and if you're willing and open, just maybe talk a little bit about the struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm an open book as that is concerned. I don't mention the name of the group that I meet with more because I don't believe in my anonymity as so much as protecting, those groups, because people could say, God, that guy's a real a-hole. I want to get help, but I'm not going there, So I like to protect my group from me. But but I am an open book in terms of myself. People can always, quote, blow my anonymity. I'm like, whatever, I'm here to help. So it is one of those things. I always had a penchant for drugs and alcohol. I always had a love for those. I was raised in Marin County in the 70s. Think peacock feathers, hot tubs, lots of marijuana. And my parents weren't hippies by any means, but that was the environment. And I had, friends' parents have pot and all that kind of stuff. So I was introduced too young to drugs and alcohol. I'd say probably 12, but by 14 or 13, I was using something every night, I think, up until maybe 39 years old. And then I had maybe 6 months of sobriety, and then I went back out. So, okay, I was able to maintain. I mean, my first 2 years of high school, as I mentioned, I didn't really go to school. I was having problems probably acting out on a divorce between my parents and all that fun stuff. So, but, everybody's like, wow, you got it together, quote unquote. You went to school, you went to college, you went to a really great grad school, you taught, you had businesses. I did all of that with a very high level of maintenance use. So I'd always been an active drug user, just stayed away from the heavily addictive stuff for quite a while. I'd take little dives into cocaine or opiates, and I would kind of go up and then I'd come back down. Well, by the time I got married, when I was 30, I really was just kind of drinking beer, smoking pot occasionally, and really maintained well. But there is something that did change in my life on the external. I mean, there's a lot of different things. Like I always like to say in my meetings, if I'm, having to share for a half hour, I always like to say, well, I was an alcoholic because my wife made me so, and everybody laughs, right? But there is a dynamic. So got married. My wife at that time, she's in her own program and she's not an addict, and she has come a long way too, but that's her own business. But at first, our marriage, she was very dependent on me alone, and she didn't really like me hanging out with others and this and that, but it was okay because we had a pretty good marriage. But remember, I'm a community-oriented person. My fulfillment comes from interactions in helping others. I need that. Well, we had our firstborn, and my wife had, pretty bad postpartum. And a lot of people will know that wives absolutely despise their husbands for a while. when the baby's born, we can't do anything right, blah, blah, blah. Before my first was born, I was teaching. And I was teaching in a small private high school. I had a lot of independence. I rewrote the curriculum for the whole history department. I ran it. And then I decided, because I always had work on the side, some contracting work, I decided, wow, well, I'm just going to go full bore into contracting, building contracting, and not teach anymore. And because I have a son being born, and I want my wife to be able to stay home. So one of the directors of the school says to me, Brian, you will be successful at whatever you really like to do. And that stuck with me, because why was I mean, here's the rhetorical question to everybody out there. Why did I make that change? I made that change for money. I made that change. Well, it's good. You're making a sacrifice for your family. But wait a second. I was leaving a built-in community. I was leaving having colleagues, having a group of students, watching those students grow. I was leaving something that was integral to my personhood. And so when I go into business, as you know, Brock, it can be a lonely venture. You are on your own. I did not have many buckets out there of social outlet. I had my home, which wasn't that great, and then I had my business, which was hard. Well, being alone allowed me, you know, I was hurting inside. I was starting to hurt. And what, I mean, I know what to do with hurt. I've been doing it my whole life. Use, you know, add drugs and alcohol, right? Mm-hmm. So things got out of hand. It just kept getting worse and worse. I didn't hate my wife, but it sure felt like she hated me. And I was just, you know, whenever I went home, you know, that was even worse. So most of the time I spent, I just was out of it. And I kept getting more and more out of it until it became an extreme problem. When I was losing money, getting in debt, using hard drugs, then crashing cars, and then getting kicked out of the house, then the divorce papers said, which never went through, obviously, and then eventually ending up in jail too many times with heavy amounts of drugs on me, to the point where I said, I give up. It was the time that I was picked up. Well, I wasn't picked up that much, but I was picked up twice in probably 10 days. So the second time I picked up, I was probably facing some major charges. They put me in a jail cell, and the jailer came up. They have to give you toilet paper for your cell, right? So he picks up the roll of toilet. He has the roll of toilet paper, and he throws it at me, and it hits my face. Did I resent the jailer? Actually, I didn't. At that point, I did not resent him. I did not resent my wife. I did not resent anything. I knew suddenly that I belonged there. Mm. And that was a huge realization. That was just huge, that somehow I could not protest that, wait a second, you know, I was a great student. I got all these degrees. I've had two different businesses, been very successful. Well, of course, that success was screwed after a while, but very successful, blah, 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 blah. And then I didn't feel that way anymore. I felt I'm a criminal. This is where I belong, so I don't hurt anybody. So I don't crash my car into somebody and all of that. So that was, I guess some people would call it in the various programs of recovery, a God moment. I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily call it that, but it was a wake up call. And I did agree to go to get back into recovery and go to a rehab. And really since then, there was a time when I got out of rehab and I was in a quote halfway house, but a great house with a bunch of guys. That at that point I did find some in my stuff and I used it. But then, since November 10th, 2006, I haven't had a drink or a drug one that's not caffeine or something like that. So that's the long story of that.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm sure it's not always pleasant to go back to that place. I wanted to ask you though, when you were in that jail cell and you had that moment when the jailer hit you with the roll of toilet paper and you didn't feel like you were blaming him. Do you feel like up until that point, there was a part of you that blamed other people, or was that moment so freeing and that you finally felt like you took responsibility for everything that had happened? What was that moment about?
I was relieved. I think I had blamed everybody. Definitely blamed my wife and how she had treated me, right? I knew I was an addict. I knew I was having problems, but I didn't care. I knew I was probably on the way to death, but I just didn't care. And at that point, I guess I cared enough to take responsibility and to suddenly feel, I felt a relief. I felt, okay, I'm willing to surrender. I'm willing to finally let go. And I guess that was the first time I felt, okay, I'm ready to get back in. Into the life, into actual life. And one of the beauties, of course, of recovery is it's all about community. It's all about helping others. It's everything that was in that early development of myself, of my ego, the good part of the ego that was reintroduced to, you know, that we get rid of the bad ego, but we have a sense of individuality, and that's good. But that sense was reintroduced in recovery.
So you started going to recovery and meetings and so forth, and, you know, talk to us about maybe some of the, because nothing's easy. I mean, you didn't get to where you are 12 years later perfectly. No. What were some of the struggles of once you committed to start, you know, going to meetings and getting help?
Well, I think the hardest struggle for most people is just the urge to drink or use. Because what happens is the drugs, I'll just call them drugs, includes alcohol, whatever. Drugs are a way for us to medicate ourselves because there's a deeper issue inside. There's some, I believe we're born, you know, spiritually whole. I hope I'm not using spiritual too much. I do not want to turn off listeners. It's not about God or it was your idea of God. Okay, good. But you are spiritually whole. You are, you know, perfect in a way. You know, I would call it perfect in our imperfection. But something happens along the way. And some of us get more broken than others. I remember there was a lot of chaos in my house, of course. And you know, those were the times of men go out and work and women, blah, blah, blah. So a lot of stress on my dad that came out in bad ways. My brother could be, you know, he was a kid, but he was abusive more because he's hyperactive. I could make excuses, you know, whatever. We're all just humans. But I reacted. I was scared, I think. And from a very early age, I really remember knowing this in my heart, that life is about, not about what's going on here, not about what was going on in society. I felt a great deal of hurt by looking at the hurt in the world. And I focused on that because as kids, we were just amazed. I think when we first experienced that, and some of us more than others, we're floored by the hate. We're floored by the fear. We're like, what is this? This is not the way we're supposed to be. And I think a lot of my early exploration was one thing to cover my feelings, but another way was also I believed that there was better life through maybe psychedelic use or something like that. But I was broken. And so we do, as addicts, have a pre-existing condition, if you will. Mine tends to be a little bit on the bipolar spectrum, this or that. So when you take away the drugs and alcohol in early recovery, you're left with the same thing you had before that you were trying to medicate. So you got to find a way. And so through the steps of various programs, through meditation, whether you do steps through Buddhism or whatever, but those old AA steps are really the pinnacle of so many different parts of recovery, because they are a means by which we're able to get whole again without having to cover up. So I would say the most difficult time are those first few months when you don't have anything. It's not until you start doing the actual work of the program and helping others right away. You got to give guys rides to meetings right away. You got to make coffee. You know, you got to get involved. Until you get that, you're just going to be hurt. So I think it's that transformation. I had a very lucky one because I was so willing to try something else. A lot of people aren't so willing. I surrendered. I'd given up, and I felt a lot of. So my early story was not as dark. When I finally got back home, which was 6 months later, our relationship was pretty darn good because we were both in recovery. But I could talk about more of the recovery and the good parts, because the early recovery for me was only bad in so much as is, you know, you get those urges and you want to use and you don't have anything there yet. But it didn't take me long to get something.
So one of the things I'm getting from that process was, it sounds like when you finally got outside of yourself and you were giving back to others, being part of that group and community, it sounds like in many ways. Do you think that's one of the key elements of successful recovery is people serving people and kind of losing themselves?
I believe so. I believe some of the most successful entrepreneurs, the people who get sober, who have a problem with addiction. I don't know enough about mental illness. I mean, I've got my own issues, but to say that, but I believe a lot of our cure for neuroses and success comes through being of service to others, even on an entrepreneurial level. I believe that you have to, look at Richard Branson, what he talks about, how treating others is how he's become successful, whether it's through employees or business structure. So going back to recovery, that is the solution, if you will, is to get outside yourself, to at least act as if you're not as important as you once thought you were. Of course, right. You're important, but you must give. You have to give. Integrate. I would say give, integrate. They're both the same things, because sometimes giving is just being there. You know, I'm in the Mentor Me program, so I have a mentee. Most of what we do is show up. Sometimes kids don't want to talk, you know?
Yeah.
Stuff's going, and you're like, well, hey, is there anything you want to talk about? No. You know, and sometimes, and really, you just got to be there. And so sometimes it's extremely easy. Just show up.
Right. And to that, I think we've all felt just the presence of certain people that bring our energy level up. And we all know when, like, there's just an odd feeling in the room because someone's super depressed, or they're being really negative about something, or maybe they're negative about their whole life. And you feel that, versus someone that comes in a room, you're just like, I just feel good right now. So that's such a great point. I think people... Brian, I lost you for a minute. I don't know what happened.
Yeah. Are you able to splice and stuff on this?
I think so. So let's just keep rolling.
Okay. We're talking about the energy in the room and the positivity versus maybe somebody who's having a hard time.
Yeah. I want to shift gears because I really want to hear about how you got into ultra running and kind of dissect that a little bit more. So did you grow up running? When did you officially start to call yourself a runner?
I would say for a very short time between, I'd say about 12 years old. So about the time I think my youngest son started running trails. About 12 years old. And I ran off and on. Right at the, pretty much at the base of the most beautiful running trails in Marin County. I mean, come on. I lived right there. And so I didn't run every day or anything, you know, kind of kid-like. And I probably ran through to my, till about 18.
Okay. So, and how far were you just kind of going out for fun at that time?
Yes, or? Yeah. 8 miles, this or that. Didn't know anything about distance. Didn't have any interest in roads or marathons because, I mean, I didn't have any idea about the trail community. There was some stuff, but they were all adults. Most of my friends didn't run. So yeah, just out for fun.
So when did you really get into the ultra scene?
The ultra scene probably 3 years ago now, maybe four. I'd just say three. Two with ultra distances, 1 year with just, under marathon trail runs. And so it's been very recent. I started running again 7 years ago. Mostly concrete and around the house, because once I kind of got my insides worked out, suddenly I had to work on my outsides, you know, my physical body and stuff.
Yeah.
So for the last 7 years, I've been working on that. But yeah, very recent with the Ultra Trail. Yeah.
So you started running, but you know, to get in shape again, and then, you know, I mean, that's running just under trail marathons is certainly nothing to scoff at. I mean, for 99% of the population, that's remarkable. When did you kind of increase the distance slowly, or what motivated you to want to kind of keep pushing the limits?
It was pretty fast, very fast. Within 1 year, I'd gone from 50Ks to 100Ks. So
wow.
That was pretty quick. And then I've paced, you know, 100 milers and stuff like that. So, and I paced 100 miles of the Tahoe 200. So really pretty recent push through that. I just learned that if I up my mileage, that I'm pretty much ready for anything right now. I've really gotten to that point where if I keep my mileage around 50 miles a week, I can go out, I can do 100 miles, you know, not fast, but my body's used to it. I'll do a marathon plus every week as a long run. So I'm one of the lucky ones. I actually have time to work on that. So yeah, it happened quickly. The transformation was just, I want to spend more time in the woods. I want to work on how I think, you know. Sometimes, you know, a lot of people say within 6 hours out in the woods running, you've pretty much figured everything out, you know. And so I empty my brain probably in the first 2 or 3 hours. I think about stuff, anything that's worrying me, blah, blah, blah. And then probably the last couple hours, I'm just one with the woods for a while, you know. I'm not really thinking a lot. Which is great.
So true. I've noticed that so many times. It takes an hour or two or three just to get the chatter out of your mind, and then it does go.
It does. So what else could I, you know, this is perfect for the introverted extrovert, right? You get to be out in nature alone, right? Blah, blah, blah. And then you have races and pacing and being part of people's crew. So it's this mix. So last year I pretty much decided I'd do a race a month, at least a 50K or higher every month, because, you know, I need to be part of that community. I got to watch out for isolation. Solitude is fine. Isolating is not.
So. Right, right.
So yeah, so it's a great mix for me in that way.
Well, let's dive into that deeper, because I think that is so real. And I've noticed just in the 2 short years I've kind of jumped into this community of ultra runners, I've noticed the same thing. First of all, there's quite a few people that really openly admit a lot of depression issues. And
yes.
It is and can be a very lonely sport. I came from the cycling world. It's very similar, where a lot of long hours by yourself in many cases, and it does get lonely. So let's maybe dive into that and just some of the ways you've seen of how you can balance that isolation tied in with community, so to speak.
Yeah, I would say it's kind of like How about this? This is kind of funny. It's like going to individual therapy, like having a couple go each going to individual therapy and then going into therapy together. You need to work on yourself to be of maximal service to others. If I'm not taking care of myself, I can't be. So that's why sobriety comes first. If I'm not sober, I have nothing. So I got to take care of the self. So working like on just myself, being okay with myself, being okay with my own thoughts, allows me to go in to races, whether pacing, volunteering, crewing, running, and be open and embrace others when they need help. Somebody falls, whatever. Hey, Brian, can you crew me? Yeah, I think I can. You know, just I would not be able to do that if I wasn't mentally sober, you know, if I wasn't taking care of myself. And so maybe the solo is what's helping me with the group.
So I want to bring that out because I think that's something every single person can relate to, whether they're a runner or not, are those self-care practices. Mm-hmm. You know, what fills Brian Paisley up every day? What are some of the practices?
Oh my gosh, I am so lazy. I think I mean I have the best job ever, and that is I was able to quote retire a little bit early, and I work for my wife now. And I have the best job ever because I am working in a shop, and it's a gift shop. And of course, most people who shop there are lovely people, mostly women, which is great because I socialize. I tend to socialize quicker with women. I mean, I love men a lot. You know, they're my rock. But it's easier for me to, because I'm flirtatious, I guess. I don't know. Whatever. My wife rolls her eyes. She's like, I mean, after 22 years of marriage, she's like, whatever. So I think I what really turns me on, hate to say it, is really, I mean, not hate to say it, but hate to be the dead horse, is once again, is being there for others. You know, I don't really want to do a lot. You know, I'm just as lazy as the next guy. It's not like I want to pick up a shovel and go help, but I want to be able, when I'm out in the world, to be as of use as ever, you know, whether I'm the one guy who smiles or whatever it is. So what I guess what gives me a lot of my push, it's really just that I'm alive now and I could be of service. Now, what is my, what do they say in business? What is your why? Oh my gosh. It, you know, there's just too many things. It's really hard for me. I mean, people hated me in business because I was like, I don't know, everything, you know? I can't really be specific. There isn't one thing. I think my biggest why right now are my family and my friends. Is just I do it, I stay alive and I get psyched and I get amped because of, I think maybe my biggest why right now is nature. That's what gets me out. Other than that, you know, I play music and stuff. I have so many passions, it's hard for me to delineate. I just am pushed by the energy of life. What about, yeah, because, well, I mean, you know, I hate to throw it on you, but, you know, what is one of your whys? Maybe that would help me explain it better.
You know, it's always a good question, and I agree with you. I don't think there's always one answer. You know, some people say 100% their kids. Some people say 100% to, you know, serve their community, whatever it is.
Right. But
I think for me, I agree, and I've been in some dark places too, where now once you finally feel whole, and that doesn't mean you're perfect by any means.
Not every day, right?
There's days that just suck, but it is, I think, seeing what impact you can make on the world. And I think the older we get, the more we realize, like, hey, is anyone going to remember me after I'm gone? And if so, you know, how would they remember me? Like, what was my impact? And I think the older we get, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that starts to drive people a little bit more. And there's no specific age I think that hits. I just think it's the development of the self, and we all hit that maturity level and that perspective at a different time. But
right.
I mean, yeah, I love that. Just being able to say we're impacting the world in some way.
Exactly. So, that's a really good way to put it. That's just very succinct, because I feel that way too. I mean, and I'm a little bit older, but definitely it grows with every year. Whether it's just, you know, going into the recording studio, and whether or not there's a lot of people going to listen to it or not, it's great to have that in the archives of history. But really, for me, yeah, it's children, and then the people, my children, and then the people I can have an effect too. So yeah, definitely.
So I want to go back to, because I think it's such a great metaphor for life, you know, pacing another ultra runner. For those that don't, you know, because this podcast isn't just ultra runners that listen, you know, explain maybe to the audience, what does pacing entail? You know, what does that really mean?
It has got to be one of the most rewarding experiences. I haven't had a runner quit yet, but every runner wants to. You know, if it's 100 miles plus, you're going to run into people who just want to quit. But you're really there 100% for the runner. I mean, it is not about you at that point. I mean, it's, you got to take care of yourself by eating at aid stations, bringing food, blah, blah, blah. But what it is I meet people online who live far away, whether they're in Canada or most recently Idaho, people who are very different from me. They might be conservative. They might be, you know, I've run with people with very different political beliefs or whatever. It doesn't matter. I'm there to serve them. And so I meet them. You know, usually pacers will meet them, you know, let's say if it's 100 miler, it'll be 40 miles in. If it's 200 miler, maybe 100 miles in. And you run behind them and you keep them as happy as possible. Keep them thinking that they can do it. You know, it's all about keeping their mental game on. At one point, I just wasn't sure with this woman I paced a week and a half ago. I just wasn't sure because she was having problems with her hip. And all I could tell her was, I've seen a lot worse. Let's go. And I knew she would stop if it was going to injure herself. So really what it's about, it's just about helping her and she, her or him, helping them have the best race possible. And for you, hey, you get a free run in, you get free food, you get to see the trail, you might be able to go run that trail on the race next year if you've never run it before. So it's just a win-win. It's a beautiful thing.
So, and not, if I understand correctly, not all ultras actually allow pacers, is that right? But the far majority do, correct?
Yeah, after some 50 miles allow, but all 100 miles plus definitely allow it. 50 miles usually allow it. Yeah, after like mile 30, they'll allow pacers on. So, yeah. And but the struggles are the ones that are overnight. Like, you know, for me, like on a 100 miler, you typically meet your runner sometime between 3 p.m. and 5 p.m. and you're running overnight with them. So it can be even tough, even though you're doing a shorter distance. You think, oh, it's fine. You know, they'll be tired. It'll be a nice, slow, easy pace. Well, not so much. You know, starting that late and going overnight can be tricky.
What's one of the most challenging situations you've ever been in as a pacer? Where maybe someone had a complete meltdown or they hallucinated?
Actually, it's not, believe it or not, it's not that. It is Tahoe 200. A guy that I was pacing, he was great. He was wonderful. But the biggest problem I had was we finally got to a place where we could get 3 hours of sleep in. And, you know, they have sleep stations for these 200 milers. And, of course, the clock is running just for you people out there. It's not like they turn the clock off when you go to sleep. So I was like, oh, okay. So his girlfriend was kind of crewing him, which is a really bad idea, because kind of crewing means that they don't know what to do. They're there to give hugs and kisses. Well, he ended up, you know, because they could sleep in their car. He went to the car to sleep. I went to their. So here I am texting him at 2 a.m. saying, hey, dude, we got to go. He said, oh, I haven't slept a wink. I was pissed off. I was like, dude, what are you doing? I mean, he was fine, but I would say sometimes it's the runners not taking care of themselves that's the hardest. Blisters, stuff like that. They haven't dialed in their footwear. They haven't taken care of themselves, haven't eaten enough. You kind of inside want to yell at them, but you know you can't. I would say that's very difficult. I'd say on that last run, the physical stuff, it is difficult not to know whether somebody is actually really injured or not. But one thing somebody told me is they said, if they are really injured and they do further injury to their body, they will know. I'm not 100% sure of that, so that's tricky. Meltdowns, that's typical. Just lots of hugs. Doesn't matter what gender they are. If you're married and you're pacing a female runner, don't worry what your wife or husband thinks. Give them hugs, help them up, and just be encouraging. The meltdowns are okay. We all have them. You know, I don't know anybody who's done 100 without tears. I mean, maybe some guys. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I cry when I pace 60 miles, you know. It gets so late and you start hallucinating. You're like, oh, you know, I just want to eat more and I just want to sleep and blah, blah, blah. So what is great is that we do go to these pain thresholds with each other and we bring each other through. There couldn't be a more beautiful thing because life causes pain in general and we put ourselves through this pain. So we learn very quickly not to blame life because we're at a point where we're like, yeah, I've been through that and I've put myself through this much pain. You know, I can make it. I can endure. I can get by.
Absolutely. I mean, there's undoubtedly for anyone listening that's maybe pondering starting to run or getting into ultra endurance sports, there's without a doubt there's a bond that is had when you go through that much pain with someone, when you go through something so hard. You know, I think we see this in similar situations where people all endured a plane crash together and lived or, you know, some type of catastrophe. But when it's so hard and you go to that brink and then you come back together, there's undoubtedly this unshakable bond for life in many ways. So, tell me how you've kind of seen that manifest, Brian.
The manifestation is, I would say, the amount of care somebody shows you after you've met them out on the course, how you become fast friends for life, that you start, you just spent 15 hours with them on the course. You've never met them before, but suddenly you're like, you know, nobody's invited me to be their best man or anything like that yet, but that's the kind of thing they reach out to you. Times of trouble, I've had calls from people I've paced or been with, races. I mean, what it is it's very much like recovery. We all managed to get through that shipwreck and we are all together. There's something that ties us deeper than most relationships. I mean, that allows us to just, you know, mixed gender, just pee in front of each other. Talk about chafing. And, you know, we don't care. You know, we're not in it for sexuality or anything like that. We're there to support each other. It's just an amazing thing. It is recovery. It's the same kind of idea. It's weathering through something. So I'd say the biggest example is that people are willing. I'm doing the Tahoe 200 next year. I'm actually running it. How many people, as soon as I told them, said, I want to be on your crew. I want to pace you. You know, this is like, oh, great. So you want to be on the crew? That means you don't mind staying up all night and wondering where I am and being bored as hell. Nope, I'm there for you, buddy. I don't even know you. Oh, yeah, I've run with you once. So that's what I'm talking about.
Well, it's so fascinating because I think most people looking into the ultra scene or ultra community from the outside literally would just think you guys are crazy. Like, why do you do this? You're definitely not getting paid for it. You're actually paying money to do it. Uh-huh. In most cases. So, you know, the question always comes up, why do you do it? So I would ask you the same question, Brian, and this maybe kind of be our parting conversation. why do you do it and why do you love it?
Why do I love it? That is always the big question, is why do we do 100s? Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Good. I'd gotten a text or something. Yeah. So why? We, you know, some people will say, you know, why do you climb a peak? Oh, because it's there. I would say it has to do with, for me, gosh, there's so many reasons, but one of them is to just is curiosity. How far can I go? That would be when I first got into it and started upping my mileage. Can I do this? Second is, for me, is nature, of course. Nature's always been the big push that gets me out of the door in the morning, is that, wow, I'm going to, you know, drive 30 minutes, be at the coast and run in the mountains. You know, that's huge. But to do an extremely long one, it is. It's about living through the shipwreck. It is about the drama. Life can get pretty stale for most of us. We go to work, we feed our kids, we do our duties. When you're out there doing this, you're experiencing something that's very difficult but very rewarding. So it is an adventure. I think it's our sense of adventure that really pushes us.
I love it. And Brian, where can our listeners find you, follow you, track your journey into this next year?
Oh, well, you know what? I've got to get on Instagram a little more, but definitely look up Brian Paisley, Petaluma, California, on Facebook. So it's Petaluma, California on Facebook. PM me if you want to exchange phone numbers. Just like me. If you add me as a friend, send me a PM and tell me how you know me from this podcast. But I'd love to get to know. I mean, the more the better. That's what I always say with people. The more we can connect, the better. I think we're all more successful when we do it together.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll have for all of our listeners, we'll have links to the show notes and how you can find Brian with his Instagram and Facebook handles on there. So,
great.
Brian, this has been super fun, man. I really appreciate the time and you doing this today.
Hey, thanks. I really enjoyed it as well. It's always great to tell what I can.
Thank you, guys. And thank everyone for listening. And if you like this channel, go ahead and subscribe to it and share the good word. We'll continue to do more awesome episodes. Have an awesome day, everybody. Thanks again, Brian.
Thank you. Bye.